It is a privilege to be here today, passing on to you not only the teachings of my great teacher, Shunyu Suzuki Roshi, but by passing on the meaning of his teaching, giving meaning to the practice of all of the great Buddhist ancestors, all the way back to Shakyamuni Buddha. While Shakyamuni Buddha was alive, he offered his disciples a choice of things to meditate on while they meditated, which is what they did most of the day. They went begging in the morning, and then they ate, and then they meditated, or else they also listened to maybe his Dharma talk. But he gave them a choice of two subjects for their meditation: the Four Noble Truths, which we've already talked about. And if you want to refresh your memory, I'm going to do that in a second too. But what the Buddha taught. That was one of the series, what the Buddha taught. What the Buddha taught was the Four Noble Truths. And so you can go back there if you find yourself really wanting to study that more. And the other one is the 12 links of dependent arising, which is what we're going to study this series, and is what the Buddha chose for himself for his own daily meditation. I think he was really pleased with himself for discovering what he discovered in these 12 links, which is how we create, what is the mental process that we go through to create our own suffering. And it was brilliant. So that's what we're going to be doing. We've already gone over the Four Noble Truths, but I want to just remind you of what they are. And by the way, the word noble, if you refer to a noble person, it means enlightenment. So a noble truth, therefore, would mean the words or the ideas, the thoughts of an enlightened being. So the Four Noble Truths mean truths coming from a mind of enlightenment. So just to say that. And the Four Noble Truths are, the first noble truth is life is suffering. And it means we can't escape suffering. And suffering means ordinary suffering, like bad things happen, violence, theft, and so forth. And also the inevitable impermanence of old age, sickness, and death, not only of ourselves, but for all those whom we cherish and love. Even people for whom it looks like everything went really well for them this lifetime, even those people are going to lose everything they have and care about. So that's suffering. That's the truth of suffering. And the second truth is there's a cause for our suffering. And what is the cause? It's the false understanding we have about the nature of our existence, and the behavior that results from this false understanding. And this is going to be the subject of this series. And on this is what the 12 links of dependent arising is about. It's suffering that dependently arises from us and our thought process and our values and desires, lifetime after lifetime. The third noble truth is that suffering can cease. It's possible to end our cycles of suffering. We can do that. And the fourth noble truth is how to do that. the Eightfold Noble Path. So following this path will lead to the selflessness required to end our cycles of suffering. So we've studied the Eightfold Path when we studied the Four Noble Truths in that series, What the Buddha Taught. This series is on the second noble truth, the cause of our suffering. And if we completely understand precisely what keeps these cycles rolling, it becomes possible to stop them. And even if we're already sort of doing the right things, it's extremely helpful to see the whole picture and where our current efforts fall in the whole picture. That way we can also see what might be missing and where we might profitably put our future effort. So just to pause for a second right here, a lot of people don't realize several important things that I've already said today. Some don't realize that life is suffering. They don't realize impermanence and that everywhere that and which is everywhere and pervades every single thing. And they don't realize that everyone, including themselves, will experience old age, sickness, and death. Some don't realize that we actually live lifetime after lifetime and that we've all been around since beginningless time. I'll say more about that later. Some don't realize that we are fundamentally deluded in how we see ourselves existing and that we're not inherently independent individuals, but rather interconnected with all other beings. And especially some don't realize that based on our delusion about the nature of our existence, our habits and proclivities are also diluted. And as a result, selfish and destructive. So because they don't realize the correct nature of our existence, actions that are taken are selfish and destructive without even people realizing that. Finally, and the big thing that many don't realize, is that Buddha exists to fix this, that Buddhism is around to help us end our suffering. Buddhism offers us a way out of suffering. That's what it's for. Honest to God, some people don't realize this. This series is on the mental phenomenology of suffering. The 12 links in our thought-feeling process that Buddha discovered as he sat under the Bo tree that lead directly to our suffering. They dependently arise, each one linked to the one before it, but we need to fully understand. So the first thing we need to fully understand is dependent arising. What is dependent arising? And the Dalai Lama answers this question so beautifully. I'm really going to base just about everything I say about this on what he says. And I want to introduce you to the Dalai Lama because some people don't understand that he is a major Buddhist scholar and intellect. He was taken away from his family about age 3 and was individually educated to pass the most difficult exams that Buddhism offers. He's like the Pope of Buddhism, not only because we love him, but because behind the scenes, he's passed these exams that only a handful of others have passed. So, I mean, he knows everything. So when he speaks on a subject as he has spoken on this subject, we can rely on what he says. He definitely knows exactly what he's talking about. So I feel really confident about about this series, because I'm relying on, I think he gave 5 talks on this subject, and the talks were made into a book. And then also there was a foreword to the book that was very useful. So I'm drawing on all of this for what I'm going to be giving to you starting today. So first of all, he says that while the main factor independent arising is behavior, because this decides both our own and others' happiness in the future, in order for behavior to be pure and complete, it's necessary to have the right view. So behavior must be well-founded in reason, and so the proper philosophy is important. They're all interrelated, behavior and actions and thoughts and feelings, they're all interrelated. So what is the view or the main goal of Buddhist practice concerning behavior? It is to tame one's mind and become nonviolent. To tame one's mind and become nonviolent. Therefore, the root of all Buddhist teaching is compassion. The Buddha is even said to be born from compassion. The chief quality of a Buddha is great compassion, and this attitude of nurturing and helping others is the reason why it's appropriate to take refuge in the Buddha. Dependent arising is a general philosophy of all Buddhist systems, even though many different interpretations are found within those systems. The Sanskrit word pratyasamuppada, I'm not sure I pronounce, pratyasamuppada, means that which arises in dependence upon conditions, in reliance upon conditions, through the force of conditions. So cause and effect. Cause and effect, it's the basis of Buddhism. If one does not understand cause and effect well, it's extremely difficult to realize that phenomena are empty of inherent existence due to being dependently arisen. So we absolutely have to understand dependent arising, because our suffering dependently arises, and the way we are in the world dependently arises. Hence, the Buddha set forth a presentation of dependent arising in connection with cause and effect of actions or behavior in the process of continuous life in cyclic existence, that is lifetime, of lifetime after lifetime of suffering and death. Now the Dalai Lama presents dependent arising as taking place on 3 increasingly deeper and more subtle levels. And I'm going to tell you what those are, but we're only going to be talking about the first level, which is basically cause and effect. So level 1 of dependent arising is concerned with causality. And in this case, the 12 branches are links of dependent arising of life and cyclic existence. That's all. So there's the dependent arising. It's really the cause and effect of lifetime after lifetime that we undergo because we don't understand what we're doing. Okay, so that's the first level, and that's really all we'll be doing. But I want you just to hear that there are 2 other levels to dependent arising. The second deeper level is that applies to all objects, all phenomena, is the establishment of phenomena dependent on their parts. So there's no thing that doesn't have parts. And so every phenomena is reliant on its parts, is imputed from its parts. Imputed means thought to exist from its parts. Like if there's four legs and a top, we think table. We impute table from the parts of four legs and a top, but there is no such thing as a table. It doesn't exist. So that's the second layer of dependent arising, that things depend on their parts. And the third layer is that not only do they depend on their parts, but they depend on our minds to impute the parts. It's really our minds that, so like if we see four legs and a top platform, we think table. We think table, our minds compute from the parts, the thing, but nothing can be found to be a table. The imputed object, which dependently arose, is just imputed dependent on our heads. And we do the same thing for I, imputed from a set of human arms and legs and torso. But when we look for the I, nothing can be found. So so we're going to be doing cause and effect right now in this series. But while we're doing it, you can play around in your head with, see if you can find your I. I do this and I do that. See if you can find that. That'll be helpful. So when the Buddha set forth the 12 links of dependent arising, he spoke from a vast perspective with great import. He taught the 12 links in detail in the Rice Seedling Sutra. So a sutra named the Rice Seedling Sutra. In this sutra, he speaks of dependent arising in three ways. And Sahara, you can put up the chart now if you would. So the three ways that he talks, and this chart, by the way, will be on the website, and I'm going to ask you later to download it so you have it right in front of you for all of the talks in this, the rest of this series. But for now, the Buddha speaks of dependent arising like in three ways. One is due to the existence of this, that arises. Due to the production of this, that is produced. And finally, it is thus. Due to ignorance, the first one, number one, ignorance. Due to ignorance, there is action, number two. And don't worry about that term. It'll become clear. And then due to action, there's consciousness. And don't worry about there's two kinds of consciousness. We'll deal with that. Due to consciousness, there's name and form. And this term too will become clear. Due to name and form, there are six sense spheres. Due to the six sense spheres, there's contact. Due to contact, there's feeling. Due to feeling, there's attachment. Due to attachment, there's grasping. Due to grasping, there is the potentialized level of karma called existence. And then due to existence, there is birth. Due to birth, there is aging and death. So when the Buddha says, due to the existence of this, that arises, he indicates that the phenomena of cyclic existence arise not through the force of a supervision by a permanent deity, but due to specific conditions. So merely due to the presence of certain causes and conditions, specific effects arise. So I guess this is here, it's here, like where indirectly Buddhism is stating that there's no concept of God. So where Buddhism says it's due to the presence of certain causes and conditions, specific effects arise, and that's how things are. That's all it says. It doesn't speak about God, actually, but there's an implied sense that it's not about a deity that causes things to happen. It's due to causes and conditions that things happen. That's all. I don't want to say any more about that. When the Buddha says due to the production of this, that is produced, he indicates that the phenomena of cyclic existence arrive from conditions that are impermanent by nature. So then the question arises, if the phenomena of cyclic existence are produced from impermanent conditions, could they be produced from just any impermanent conditions? And the answer is no. So in the third phrase, the Buddha indicates that the phenomena of cyclic existence are not produced from just any impermanent causes and conditions, but from specific ones that have the potential to give rise to specific phenomena. So setting forth the dependent arising of suffering, Buddha shows that suffering has ignorance as its root cause. And we're going to have two full lectures on what ignorance is, so don't worry about it. It's not you're stupid. That's not what it means in Buddhism. So this impure, faulty seed produces an activity that deposits in the mind a potency that will generate suffering by producing a new life in cyclic existence. That new life, I think, is stage 10 or something. It eventually has as its fruit the last link of dependent arising, which is aging and death. So as soon as there's ignorance, there's all these things happen in this exact chain of events, and the last of which is aging and death. And when Buddha sat under the Bo tree, he realized all of that. He just realized that, like, oh, this is how suffering comes about mentally. This is what we do, all of us, each one of us. And it seems a little too mental at first. But when you think about someone discovering that this is the process that the human being goes through to create its own suffering, we do it all by ourselves. It's kind of shocking. So I'm wondering now if I want to go through. What I was going to do next is go through the series of them. Due to the condition of ignorance, action arises, etc. But I think I'll skip that and move on to the next thing, because I've said enough about it. You'll understand all of this by the end of the series, I guarantee you. So moving on, in Buddhism, there are six psychological types of birth that beings can attain. So it's not just humans. And the psychological types are gods, demigods, humans, animals, hungry ghosts, and hell beings. And all are levels of suffering, all six of them. And due to what conditions do these forms of suffering arise? They arise due to karma or action. That word action, after ignorance comes action, and action is actually karma. There are virtuous actions and non-virtuous actions impelling beings toward lifetimes in the three lower realms. So in Buddhism, it's held that it's very difficult to achieve the prized human incarnation. From what do these karmas that are the sources of suffering arise? And the and what where did the karmas come from? The afflictive emotions of desire, hatred, and ignorance, which give rise to virtuous and non-virtuous actions, which give rise to one of the six births in cyclic existence. And I just want to add that in Buddhism, it's taught, and I've always had a hard time with this particular teaching, that every single being has at one time or another been our mother. So the next time you see an ant, you can think that that being too has at one time been my mother. So I wanted you to know that. And also the way I hold these psychological types is that they're extremely fluid and that we can be in any of them, any hour of the day. You know, you can cycle through all six any hour of the day. So we've probably all felt at some point that we're in the hell realm, for example. So don't get too hung up on this. I'm just informing you of this Buddhist idea of the of six psychological realms that we cycle through in different births. We take rebirth, not necessarily as a human being. So again, what is dependent arising? There are three ways to understand this term: cause and effect, when this happened, that which is when this happens, that happens, and that all phenomena have parts, and it's the parts that we take to be the whole thing. So the whole dependently arises based on its parts. That's what that means. And then the last one is, even the parts are imputed by our minds. So for example, in Buddhism, there's a mind-only school where everything is reduced to the mind. There's only the mind. So I want to stay with the issue of practice rather than philosophy. But for completeness, I'm telling you that the term dependent arising can include these other two. All right, so the last little piece I want to add to this talk today is after, I think this was in the Dalai Lama's first talk, and at the end he gave questions and answers. He asked for questions, and two of them I thought were really interesting, and I wanted to share them with you because I think you'll find them interesting too. They're not like right on our subject, but they're close. And anyway, they came in his talk. So one student asked, is material energy the same as mental energy? And his answer was, in general, because matter and consciousness are different, it seems that the energy associated with them would be different. With respect to mental energy, there are many grosser and subtler levels of consciousness. The grosser a level of consciousness, the grosser it is, the more it is related to the present body, whereas the subtler a consciousness is, the less connection it has with the gross physical body. Also, the subtler levels of mind are more powerful than the grosser levels. Thus, if one is able to utilize them, they are more effective for mental transformation. So he's basically saying, yes, mental energy is different from material energy, and that within mental energy, there are subtler and subtler levels. The more subtle the level of mental energy, the less related it is to our body or physical energy, and the more subtle the mental energy, the more powerful, and the more we can use it for mental transformation, that is, to go beyond, you know, awaken, for one thing. So that was that answer. And then the next one the last one. What is the most skillful way of dealing with anger and aggression without either submitting to the aggressor or becoming angry and aggressive oneself? That's the question. The Dalai Lama says, if you just keep letting anger out and expressing it, it is very difficult for this to be helpful. Since this behavior itself promotes more anger, it will not bring about any positive result. It will only increase problems. Under certain circumstances, it may be necessary to take a counteraction to stop another's wrongdoing. But I believe that such measures can be enacted without anger. In fact, without anger, the implementation of countermeasures is much more effective than when your main mind is governed by a strong afflictive emotion, because under such influence, you may not take the appropriate action. Anger destroys one of the best qualities of the human brain, judgment, the capacity to think this is wrong and to investigate what the temporary and long-term consequences of an action will be. It is necessary to calculate such circumstances before taking action. Free of anger, the power of judgment is better. And then he says one more thing. It is clear that if in a competitive society, you are sincere and honest, in some circumstances, people may take advantage of you. If you let someone do so, he or she will be engaging in an unsuitable action and accumulating bad karma that will harm him or herself in the future. I hope you're understanding this. If you let someone harm you or do a destructive action toward you, then they're accumulating bad karma that will harm them. So then the Dalai Lama says, thus it is permissible with an altruistic motivation. You have to hear that. It's permissible with an altruistic motivation to take a counteraction in order to help the other person avoid the effects of his wrong action, of this wrong action in the future. Responses should be made in that way. And he goes on a little bit. According to the sutra system, that's our system, we have the sutra system, the use of anger is not permitted in the spiritual path, period. That's it, no anger. However, in the tantric system, that's his system, there is an explanation that it's possible to utilize anger in the path. In this case, the fundamental motivation must be compassion, but the temporary motivation is anger. And the purpose is to utilize strength and swiftness of anger without coming under its negative influence so that practice becomes more effective. I've seen Suzuki Roshi do this actually. He'll be swift and he'll go around the zendo and use the kyosaku on every single person. And then he goes back and sits down. And it looks like he's extremely angry, but he's actually trying to wake us up. Like, did you get that? Just, you gotta stop your dullness. And so there's actions that look like anger. The kyosaku is very loud. But it's not anger. So then one more paragraph of the Dalai Lama's. Put another way, regarding anger and strong attachment, the more you express them, the more they will occur. With these types, restraint will cause them to weaken. However, restraint does not just mean that when you develop anger or attachment to a high degree, you attempt at that moment to control it, for this is very difficult. Rather, in daily practice, you should continuously reflect on the benefits and advantages of compassion, love, kindness, and so forth and reflect on the disadvantages, the faults of anger. Through the force of this, even when you become angry, the anger's expression changes in aspect. It changes in aspect and diminishes in force. This is the way to practice. As time passes, mental attitudes can gradually change. So I always like to boil down everything I've said to some main points, usually five main points. Today it's six main points, so that you can leave with a, like, not everything is just a blur. So here are what I think are the six main points to take away. First, Buddhism is around helping us end our suffering. Buddhism offers us a way out of suffering. That's what it's for. That's point one. I really want you to understand that. Buddhism is about, oh, we can get out of this. Some people say, oh, Buddhism is so depressing. It's just about suffering. They keep talking about suffering. But Buddhism is about how to get out of suffering. That's why they use the word, how to get out of it. All right, and the second point. What is the main goal of Buddhist practice concerning behavior? It is to tame one's mind to become nonviolent. Therefore, the root of all Buddhist teaching is compassion. The Buddha is even said to be born from compassion. So if it's a Buddhist teaching, the root of it is compassion. So first of all, those two incredibly main points. Buddhism is about ending suffering, and Buddhism boils down to compassion. Third, if one does not understand cause and effect well, it is extremely difficult to realize that phenomena are empty of independent existence, being due to being dependently arisen. We don't have independent existence because we depend on this happened, which depends on that happened, which depends on that. So everything is interconnected. Hence, the Buddha set forth the presentation of dependent arising in connection with the cause and effect of actions in the process of continuous life in cyclic existence. So he actually thought through what comes, for the first thing is ignorance, and then what comes after that, leading to suffering of old age and death. There are 12 things. So then the fourth point was the Dalai Lama's point with respect to mental energy. There are many grosser and subtler levels of consciousness. The grosser a level of consciousness, the more it's related to the present body, whereas the more subtle a consciousness, the less connection it has with the gross physical body. And also the subtler levels of mind are more powerful than the grosser levels. Thus, if one is able to utilize them, they are more effective for mental transformation. Fifth, anger destroys one of the best qualities of the human brain, judgment. The capacity to think, this is wrong, and to investigate what the temporary and long-term consequences of an action will be. So instead of just acting, we think, well, if we do this thing we're thinking of doing, what are the temporary and long-term effects of that action? Don't forget, cause and effect. So it's necessary to calculate such circumstances before taking action. Free of anger, the power of judgment is better. So sixth, restraint does not just mean that when you develop anger or attachment to a high degree, you attempt at that moment to control it. For that is very difficult, he says. Rather, in daily practice, you should continuously reflect on the benefits and advantages of compassion, love, kindness, and so forth, and reflect on the disadvantages of faults, of the faults of anger. And today I have three ideas for reflection during the week. First, did you realize that the main goal of Buddhist practice concerning behavior is to tame one's mind, to become nonviolent, and that therefore the root of all Buddhist teaching is compassion? Did you know that? As we begin to raise our consciousness about nonviolence in our own thoughts and behavior, we can see how it operates on subtler and subtler levels. So the first idea for reflection is, how do you see the nonviolence in yourself operating right now? So where in you, how does your nonviolence operate right now as you are sitting here? Can you find other ways to include nonviolence in your life? And are ways to deepen the nonviolence already in place? Also, if there are still areas of violence in your life, could you look more closely at those? So that's the first area for reflection stemming from this talk. And these three will be posted, so you don't need to write anything down. So the first one is on nonviolence in yourself, the study of that. And the second, did you know that respect to mental energy, the subtler levels of mind are more powerful than the grosser levels? Thus, if you're able to utilize them, they're more effective for mental transformation. So the idea for reflection is to give an example from your own experience of something from a subtler level of mind and something from a grosser level. And if you have had the experience of the former leading to some transformation in you, please record that. So let's start getting aware of yourself, of your levels of consciousness. So in terms of subtler and grosser. This is a little more subjective than I've given you. We've talked on and on really about the eight levels of consciousness, ending with the Alaya storehouse, the eighth level. This is more, those are, you know, level one, level two. This is more experiential, that what is a subtler level of consciousness and what is a grosser level of consciousness. So for example, for myself, I would consider my mind as a poet to be very subtle. Like I'm dealing with the koan, what is a word? And I'm just feeling what a word is day in and day out for 40 years. So you get to a very subtle level of consciousness. And then a grosser level of consciousness is, I think I spilled something and I got my shirt wet. I'm feeling it being wet right now. Something like that. That's a grosser level of consciousness. And it's more related to the physical body. But the Dalai Lama is going further. He's saying, if we can be acknowledge, really make present to yourself your subtler levels of consciousness, you can use them for your mental transformation. You know, knock, knock, awakening or enlightenment. And the third area for reflection this week is this one on anger. And so the Dalai Lama believes that the more you express it, the worse it, the more it's gonna, the more you do regarding expressing anger, the more anger you're gonna create. So that's not a way to go regarding anger. And the way to go is to daily reflect on the benefits of compassion, love, and kindness, and the disadvantages of anger. So please, first of all, for your exercise, do you agree? And if not, please be really clear about why you don't agree, and that's fine. And then the second is, if you do agree with the Dalai Lama, then record your reflections on the advantages. Record your reflections on the advantages of compassion and kindness. What are they anyway? And what are the disadvantages of anger? Why is that the wrong thing to do? And at first, your thoughts might be really obvious, but as you meditate, the longer you meditate, the more you're going to begin to see subtler and subtler ways that the ways of compassion, how it works, and the ways of anger and how it works. And actually, compassion and kindness have a way of spreading themselves to, they turn into more compassion and kindness, just ripple effect. So, and so I want you to like, not just hear that from me, but just experience that for yourself and record your experience. It's really useful to have a spiritual journal. I always ask you to do that, but however you do it, any effort in this direction is a good thing. So not to knock yourself if you don't actually keep a journal, but any effort in this direction is a good thing. Okay. I want to be leaving time for you to think of questions, but I'm worried we're going to run out of time. So I'd like to open it to questions that you have, and it can be on anything we've said so far in this series, including the first two that we're just introducing who the Buddha was, since we're going to, the whole series is on what he discovered while he was sitting under the Bo tree. Please ask your questions.
So, Gil, the first question that we have is, if I do not believe in the idea of past lives, can the Buddha's chart showing the creation of suffering be understood within the context of just one life?
I'm glad you asked. And I thought the same question for you. I don't have that problem of not believing in incarnations, but so I thought through, and actually the easiest way to understand this chart is to forget the lifetime thing. That just think of it, it's all in one lifetime. And we create it 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. We do it all in a row right now. Yes, you can understand it that way. It's meant, and I actually assumed that at first when I wanted to got the idea that I wanted to teach this, because it's not talked about all that often. It is talked about, but not that often. That's how I understood it, that it was all in one lifetime. And then I was surprised to learn that it's, that chart is actually three lifetimes. I won't go into it now because we have the rest of the series to talk about it, but it's fine. Don't worry about it. Use your effort to understand how one link fits into the other. And believe me, I'll talk plenty about it. And two whole talks will be just on ignorance, because it's so important. Just what is that? What is it anyway? So the answer is yes. Forget other lifetimes. You can just think of it as this lifetime. And thank you for asking, because I'm sure other people have that question too.
Thank you, Gail. The next one that we have is, I was so struck by what the Dalai Lama said when he said that subtler levels of mind are more powerful than the grosser levels. Thus, if one is able to utilize them, they're more effective for mental transformation. Can you say a little more about this?
Well, I too was struck, which is why I included it. And he does say more, and the more is really interesting. He says that this subtler level, at our death, it's why in Buddhism especially, it's emphasized that at the moment of death, we should be left alone. You can be have others in the room, but you should be left alone to really get in touch with the absolute subtlest level of mind that you've ever had, because it's that level of mind that passes to the next lifetime. Our subtlest level of mind passes to the next lifetime and continuously passes to the next lifetime. It is never lost. Even in enlightenment, it's never lost. So in Buddhism, when it's said that we have been around since beginningless time, that's what's been around, our subtlest level of consciousness. That's what's been around. So I guess now I'm just ad-libbing or something, but we are Buddha nature. We are Buddha nature. And Buddha nature would be our subtlest level of mind. So as we awaken, we become who we are. And who we are is our subtlest level of mind. And that's why that part of us can carry, that is the only thing that is carried from lifetime to lifetime. And I was stunned by that. And I'm really glad you asked. And maybe putting it in terms of Buddha nature helps you see how it works. But I don't want to push any thoughts on you. So that's all I want to say. That I'm really telling you what the Dalai Lama said, and you're entitled to your own reaction to that. But that is what he said, that our very subtlest level of mind is what's transferred at death to the next lifetime, and this goes on and on and on, even after awakening. He says even after enlightenment, our subtlest levels of mind are carried on. It's never lost. So you could say that it's impermanent because it keeps changing, but it's never lost. That's what he said. So thank you for asking.
Thank you, Gail. So the next one that we have is, so somebody asked that why the human incarnation is so difficult to attain. Why wouldn't the heavenly body be the most difficult? It doesn't make sense to me.
I know it didn't to me either when I first heard about this. The heavenly bodies, first of all, okay, I'm going to try to say this fast. The human incarnation is as difficult to attain as it would be for a turtle in the sea to come up for air in an inner tube. That the likelihood of a turtle swimming in the sea, coming up for air in the hole of an inner tube, which is so unlikely, that's how unlikely it is for us to get a human incarnation. I mean, since we're all humans, it's a little hard to imagine, but that's what it said in Buddhism. And then next it said that the reason that we want to be human is that it's the only incarnation where enlightenment is possible. So a heavenly being cannot attain, only the human incarnation can attain enlightenment. The heavenly being does have a marvelous existence, but because of impermanence, it ends. And when it starts to end, the glow goes off and the other people shun you. And then you depart from the heavenly realm kind of in shame. And then the second, the demigods, they spend their entire being jealous of the gods. And so they're just full of jealousy all the time. They're never happy. And so then there's the human incarnation, and the animals have to spend their whole lifetime getting food and shelter. It's very difficult for them to forget that ever. And that hungry ghosts have very thin throats, so they're starving, but they can't get food down because their throat is too thin. And then the hell beings are just surrounded by hellish existence at all times. And my understanding is this is all psychological, and that we experience all of these states of mind all the time. I know I do. I need to stop. And before I stop, I want to be sure to ask you to download, if you would, to download the chart that Brian created about these 12 links, because just to have them in front of you as we talk in the next series, it's easier to have them right in front of you than to try to remember. So if you would please do that. It's just one page. And then I want to thank you for being here, and those of you who are here during the week instead, thank you for attending and being conscientious about that. And I want to thank my team, Brian and Sahar and Brendan, who work so hard behind the scenes. It's Brian created this chart. It's really complicated. Thank you so much, all of you. And I'll see you next week. Bye-bye.